The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats.com and save 15% with promo code DEAL.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I am thrilled to have a great show for you today. We're going to address with an amazing guest one of the big conundrums in, I think, surgical ICU practice, maybe all ICU practice, which is the question of acute kidney injury in the ICU. What do we know about it? What do we do with it? And we have with us none other than a nephrologist who focuses on this. I have Dr. Samir Gautam, who is an assistant professor of medicine and nephrology. He's also the director for acute dialysis services and CRRT here at Johns Hopkins, and he is going to help us understand this better. Samir, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Zeb. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So let's start by just tell the audience a little bit about you. What is your, I already said you run the acute dialysis and CRRT services. You know, what does your day look like? How much of it is managing that? How much of it is consult or research? You know, what does your career look like these days?
I'm a clinical nephrologist. Most of my activities are surrounded around clinical activities. And 20 weeks a year, 18, 20 weeks a year, I'm in patient consults. And among that, I primarily focus on acute nephrology. We have three teams in our services, consult teams. Team A involves ICU nephrology. That's where I focus on. And I'm focusing on my clinical research, also on clinical nephrology. And then remaining in chronic nephrology and then CKD clinic, I go half day a week of CKD clinic and then outpatient dialysis. And also I champion on home hemodialysis also. And I go to one of our units here in Baltimore to do home hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. And then mostly staffing the fellows and education. And most of the education I focus on acute kidney injury in ICU and CRRT mechanics.
Great. Well, this is great. And I think will be really helpful for people. So let's dive right in. Let's define acute kidney injury. What does that mean? How do we define it?
I think that's a great question. And acute kidney injury, my background, I was in private practice before I came here. The reason I'm saying is still in a community, there is still no clear understanding of acute kidney injury and confusing with acute renal failure. Before 2000, it used to be used interchangeably acute renal failure, acute tubular injury. And because of that, there's no straightforward definition. In 2004, people came up together and came up with a definition called RIFLE criteria. And that's when they came with acute kidney injury definition. And that criteria had doubling of the creatinine within over a period of 7 days as a risk criteria, and then tripling and also creatinine more than 4 according to the staging. That's how they staged. And it did not, and between 2004 and 2007, there was a study which showed that even minuscule rise in creatinine up to 0.3 within the first 48 hours of presentation had increased clinical significance with increased mortality and morbidity and increased hospital stay in this patient. So that's why they went to change the definition for AKI with rise in creatinine of 0.3 in first 24 hours. Then there was a subset of patients who did not rise. There was not rise in 0.3, but there was some rise over the period of 7 days, doubling. So then in 2012, we have a standard definition of 0.3 milligrams per deciliter rise in 48 hours or doubling of creatinine for 7 days of hospitalization. That's acute kidney injury.
Okay, so we now define it as since 2012, as you said, as either a 0.3 rise in 48 hours or a doubling over 7 days.
Yes, that's a creatinine-based criteria. And then there's a urine output-based criteria, also like decrease in urine output of 0.5 mL per kilogram over 6 hours. That's also a urine output criteria. And we all know that, except in ICU setting, patient doesn't get good recording of urine output and there's no good data. That's why it's more creatinine-based data. Its definition is more talked about, but it's equally important. And even studies have shown that even transient oliguria, less than 3 hours of decrease in output, also has shown to have poor outcomes on these patients.
Yeah, interesting. Now, is there any, I always tell my residents, you probably sleep 8 hours at night and don't make any urine, right? And that's because theoretically, that's what you're supposed to do. And you haven't had a ton of things to drink right before bed. And so your kidneys are doing what they're supposed to do. So, if you had a patient who wasn't getting much in, but their urine output fell, that would we look more at their creatinine and say, okay, well, maybe they're not making urine because they're not, getting a lot of fluid in, as opposed to because it's injury if their creatinine didn't rise?
I think there is a catch to that discussion. I mean, there are some subsets of patients, even if they don't increase their creatinine, like, for example, people who have very poor muscle mass or very poor osmolar intake, they may not have a rise in creatinine as expected. Now, there are some set of patients that can delay the diagnosis of AKI. And there has been ongoing research on subclassifications of these patients. Like, is there any biomarker changes associated with the injury? It's not a prime time for the clinical use. But in European countries, they are using all these different sets of biomarker like nephrochecks and IGF beta protein and TIM2 as an example to see if there is a real injury on these patients, although he did not have a rise in creatinine, or someone who went to marathon had a lot of sweating but the rise in creatinine, but there was no change in the structural damaging markers. Still, that's a hot discussion in the nephrology world these days, and yeah.
Great. Yeah, I remember working with a guy, a wonderful attending named Mike Schlippek, when I was a medical student at UCSF. And this was back probably in 2007 or 8. And he was telling me about this thing, cystatin C, that he was studying. And he had a paper in the New England Journal recently about this, right? So I think it's that is one of those biomarkers, right? Cystatin C, that may be a better indicator than creatinine of kidney injury.
Yes, I think some patients, even in the clinic, I get patients who are like musculature, they have creatinine is made out of one of the metabolism of the muscle, and it's reflective of the muscle mass. So people who don't have muscle, it gets creatinine doesn't rise on these rises, but people who don't have muscle mass or sarcopenic patients, they may not have rise in creatinine. In those instances, cystatin C is a better biomarker, yeah.
Great. All right. So we've talked about the definition. Let's talk about different causes of AKI, because, I think what happens a lot is in the ICU, we have a patient and their creatinine is going up. Okay. Now, for me, because I do surgical critical care, this is usually postoperatively, but it could be someone, I think in any setting, and their creatinine is going up. And we think, okay, and what we're often taught, I think, is first think about pre-renal versus intrarenal, right? But let you decide. How do you approach this? How do you approach thinking about the potential causes of a rise in creatinine?
50% of patients who have AKI in hospital, in a broad perspective, 20% of patients who get admitted get AKI. That's in a broad sense. But among those, 50% of patients who get AKI who are hospitalized in hospital is due to acute tibial injury. And then after that, is when they're in hospital, like acute interstitial nephritis, that's most one of the under-recognized cause of AKI. And then after that, the post-obstructive. Those are three main causes. And GN, it panics a lot of residents and fellows whenever there's a creatinine rise. But it's very minuscule proportion of patients who get AKI from a GN in the hospitalized patient. Most common is acute tibial injury. And it can
when
be
like GN, that's glomerulonephritis?
Glomerulonephritis.
Okay.
And acute tibial injury is mostly it has two subsets, like ischemic and post-toxic acute kidney injury. And in the hospital, mostly in the surgical setting, is like most likely it's ischemic ATM.
Now, when we're saying ischemic ATM, we're thinking damage to the kidney itself from, let's say, hypotension in the OR or, you know, any source of ischemia to the kidney.
Yes.
And this is different than when we say pre-renal, because in a way, pre-renal can, you know, if you're pre-renal long enough, you can lead to, of course, ischemia to the kidney, right?
That's correct, yeah.
But when we think pre-renal, what we mean is you're just hypovolemic, right? You're not getting enough flow to the kidney to make urine.
Decrease perfusion to the kidneys. I just wanted to make a distinction. People who may be good volume also, some like cardiorenal, like for example, or liver patients, they may have good volume overall, but they may not perfusing adequately to the patient. So those are pre-renal, I would say.
Okay. Yeah. So pre-renal is a decrease in perfusion to the kidney. And initially, that is not causing damage to the kidney. So if you just increase perfusion, you're going to be back to making normal urine and clearing your creatinine, right?
Yes, and those are the subsets of patients who they have looked at in the studies also. When they have looked at structural biomarkers, those kind of patients, they don't have change in the biomarkers. So there's no real damage to the kidney. So as soon as you bring it down, it's normal. So, yeah.
Okay, so is it accurate? You said about 50% of AKI is from ATN,
yes,
which is acute tubular necrosis, right? Mm-hmm. So does that suggest that the other 50%, or what percent do we think is pre-renal?
20%.
Okay, so about 20%. So the minority. So most of the time, because I think we often blame it on pre-renal, right?
Yes. But
it sounds like that's the relative minority. So most of the time, it's actually the majority of the options is going to be ATN. So yes. It's either ATN. You said a small amount of the time it might be glomerular nephritis. What about the other?
I would place a number after ATN would be like pre-renal and AIN, and then GN is very, very low.
Yeah. What was after pre-renal? AI, you said?
Acute interstitial nephritis. That's like drug-induced allergic. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
And we see a fair number of patients in our hospital also. Yeah.
So how do you teach people to go about figuring out which one it is?
So first is good history and example, history and examination. And mostly examination, it may not show a lot. Mostly history, like where did they have been, what was the fluid loss, especially in surgical setting, bleeding, diarrhea, PO index. I think that helps a lot. And then after that, once you determine, and then plus once you determine by the clinical exam the patient is euvolemic, then best thing is to evaluate the urine output. Urine output is the best biomarker for AKI. And then look at the drug medication. That's one of my pet peeves, look at the medication of the patients, like have they been exposed to vancomycin? That's one of the common ones. And then aminoglycosides and sulfonyl or common cephalosporins, penicillin. Look at the drugs or aminoglycoside levels. And after that, I go and look in the microscope and how does the urine look like. If it is bland, then it's mostly hemodynamic, but frequently we see like granular materials or muddy brown cast, and it's poor man's kidney biopsy, and it's easy. We can just take the urine and look at it, go to the Osler building or one of the labs and look in the microscope. It's a 5-minute diagnosis, and once you see a lot of muddy brown cast, then that's diagnostic for acute tubular injury.
Okay, so yeah, those brown casts, right? You see this on, what are they called? Not just brown. What was the word?
Muddy brown cast.
Muddy brown cast, right? So the muddy brown casts, you see this on tests all the time. Muddy brown casts, are they diagnostic of ATN or just suggestive?
It's diagnostic. Plus, okay. In addition to the muddy brown cast, you see something called ischemic cell shedding of the renal tubular epithelial cells. Although that also can be there. And if there are renal tubular epithelial cells or granular or muddy brown cast, that's diagnostic of acute tubular injury.
Okay. So if you see that, then you've got your answer. This is ATN, probably from, if it's surgical, probably from some hypotension in the OR, right? Decreased perfusion. Is that true also of, you know, non-surgical patients, that it's probably from some hypotension at some point? Or, you know, what do we think the main causes of ATN are when it's ATN?
In septic patients are different subsets of patients. So patients who have sepsis, in the past, the thought was, okay, they become hyperperfusion to the kidneys. But now we know it's just a disproportionate blood flow to the kidney and local regional inflammation around the kidneys and blood circulation. Even though there is no decrease, the patient has maintained a good blood pressure. When they have sepsis, like white count, because of inflammatory modulation, also patient can get kidney injury. And septic AKI is different, but still in that pathway also people can get equity ranger and AKI.
Okay. So you said you got a patient, the creatinine's going up. First thing you're going to do is look at the urine output. And obviously if that's, so let's go back to that for a second. If it's low, then obviously that suggests there's a problem. Like you said, that's a good biomarker. What if it's not low? Then where does that point you? If you say, oh, the creatinine's going up, but they're making, you know, robust urine, what does that make you think of?
Still, some form of AKI, actually vancomycin-induced AKI, they are really non-oliguric AKI and have acute injury. They have somewhat better prognosis than the other oliguric AKI. And in 2012, something came up like furosemide stress test. I don't know if you have heard that or not.
Yeah.
The way it works is whatever furosemide you give to the patients or loop diuretics, from the circulation, it goes to the proximal tubule. It gets secreted to the proximal tubule. In the tubular lumen, it goes to the loop of Henle, and then that's where it blocks and causes diuresis to the patient. That tells us there's a lot of the highway. It's a highway that it takes. And based on that, if there's kidney damage, based on extent of kidney damage, the patient's response to the furosemide varies. So that's when they came up with the prognostication of these patients, so like oliguric patient who have been well resuscitated. If you give them like 1 milligrams per kilograms dosing of Lasix or furosemide naive patients, and or if they have been in furosemide in the past, 1.5 milligrams per kilograms furosemide. If you give them and if they have robust response of more than 200 mLs in first 2 hours, then that's good prognostication of these patients. Okay, they're going to do well. People who make less than that, they like likely progress from stage 1 to stage 2 to stage 3 with severe AKI, or even you can prognosticate like this patient is heading towards TAL. So that's indirect way, or somewhere in the middle that can give you an idea how this patient is going to do.
Yeah. Okay. So you let's back up a sec. So you said that if they're making robust urine, that's going to push you more toward thinking about AIN, maybe from things like vancomycin or aminoglycoside, some drug-induced injury where they can still have robust urine output but have injury. If they're oliguric, then you can do this Lasix challenge. And this I love, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, but just to repeat, the way you do this is if they're Lasix naive, 1 mg/kg. So you're talking about 100 kilo patients, you might give 100 milligrams of Lasix. If they're not, if they're on Lasix or have been on it, you might give them up to 1.5. So now you're talking about 150 milligrams for a 100 kilo patient. And you're looking for them to make 200 mLs of urine in 2 hours. And if they do that or more, obviously, then that's a good prognostic sign. Now, of course, the question that everyone's going to say, because I get this, I do this and I get it all the time. You mean you're going to give a big dose of Lasix to this person with an AKI, but Lasix is nephrotoxic. You're going to hurt the kidney, right? So what's your response to that?
I think I'm with you on that. It doesn't hurt. Especially who is the patient and what context they're giving. You know, as I said, when I started about Lasix strategies, like appropriately resuscitated patient, you know, a patient who came to the ED and has a rising creatinine, if you give Lasix, that's the wrong thing to do. But patient who has been staying in your surgical ICU for 4 or 5 days, has been well resuscitated, now has a rising creatinine, and then this is the right time to do Lasix. The way I see Lasix doesn't damage the kidney directly. The only damage you see is from the volume fluid and fluid electrolyte balance. You know, if you make him too negative, that's different. But Lasix doesn't cause damage to the kidney. That's my perception. Yeah.
I love it. I couldn't agree more. I think this is very clear. And you know, if you give a patient 100 of Lasix and they don't make any urine, and then you give them 200 and they don't make any urine, and then you give them 300, right? At some point, you're obviously going to make them pre-renal, and they're going to have kidney image damage from that. But if you give a patient Lasix and they respond well, they've obviously got the volume to give. And these days, we've got the ability to use a bedside echo. We can take a look and see what their intravascular volume looks like. If we know that they have robust intravascular volume, we're not really worried about making them dry, right? And like you said, if we know we've resuscitated them, that's very different than a patient who might be very dry. And even then, I think if you give Lasix to a patient who's very dry, nothing's going to happen, right? They're not going to urinate. And then you know that that wasn't the right answer. What do you think about giving, so often if we're really, you know, want to make somebody, you know, make urine, they're not making it. Let's say maybe they're in danger of getting reintubated because they're so volume overloaded and, you know, we're trying to stave off dialysis and we really want to try to see, will their kidneys work? We give them maybe a big dose of Lasix and some thiazide like metolazone. Do you think that's a good strategy? What do you think about that?
That's excellent strategy. And I think, not even metal, then you can block the tubule in different sectors in the kidneys or kidney tubules, and Lasix and metalazine is a good combination. I would not say metalazine in particular. Any thiazide diuretics, like chlorothalidone or ICTZ, and whatever downstream sodium reabsorption happens in the distal tubule, it can block that also and augment the diuresis. I'm all for it. Yeah.
Great. Now, everyone, I always forget this, but people say that there's a better order, right? That it's either better to give the thiazide first and then the furosemide, or the other way around. Do you have a preference?
Not really. I know people historically used to do like giving metalazone 30 minutes before Lasix, but whenever you can give. I think Lasix has a half-life of 6 hours. Metalazone has a half-life of 24 to 48 hours. It will hang around. So.
Right. Okay, great. So if you want to do it, you do the thiazide first, but probably doesn't matter. Give them both. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I love it. Yeah, that's my approach too. Okay, so safe and effective to do this, both from a trying to make them make urine and maybe avoid dialysis, so turning a oliguric AKI into a non-oliguric AKI, but also maybe giving you some prognostic information if they respond to that Lasix challenge. That's really helpful in terms of prognostication. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so...
But having said that, if the patient taking off the volume to the patients from volume standpoint, only for kidney recovery, it doesn't change at all. Kidney will recover the way it was damaged. So that's, it doesn't change, but at least you would have avoided one intervention on that patient.
Right.
Dialysis, yeah.
Now, what role, if any, does calculating a FeNA have? Now, I know you can't do a FeNA, and that's a fractional excretion of sodium. I know you can't do it if you're giving Lasix. You can do a fractional excretion of urea. But, you know, what role, if any, does that have in trying to figure out what's going on with the patient?
I don't use it, FeNA. I mean, when I was a fellow, we used to use it extensively. But it's determinant. It's based on multiple factors of the patient's amount of urine output, urine volume, and other drug interactions. And then plus other organs like liver or heart, or the patient has received a radiological dye or not. You know, there are so many factors that affect that fractional excretion of sodium. So personally, I don't use it. And based on the urine examination, physical exam, I think that's enough to make a determination.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think we often think about, or we were all taught in med school, right? Look at the BUN to creatinine ratio, look at the FeNA. These will help you differentiate pre-renal from intrarenal. It sounds like from your perspective, it's way better to do an exam and figure out if they're actually intravascularly volume down, yes, and then look at the urine in the microscope, and that'll give you your answer. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
All right, and we're back. And I was asking Samir if it's just better, in his opinion, to just take a look under the microscope and not worry about FINA and all that stuff.
That's correct. And our patients are much more different than when we were in medical school. These patients, our patients have like something like diabetes, heart problem, liver problem. And it gets the fraction gets the modified, you know, so yeah.
Yep. Now, for those of us who don't know how to look at urine under a microscope, what would you recommend? Do we just send a urinalysis and that'll give us the information we need? Or do we ask our nephrology colleagues to look at it for us? You know, what's the way to do that so that you can get that information if you don't know yourself how to go look?
The best way to do is call us and call the nephrology colleagues and we'll take a look at it. Otherwise, urinalysis, it may indirectly, you have to interpret it, what's the specific gravity, is there isostenic urea or not. There's indirect ways to do that. At least that will help you, the RBCs in the urine or WCs in the urine. But for the Mardi Brown cast, the only thing is either we can train the residents or the one of our fellows, or we can take a look at it.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Now, let's just say somebody's listening who's in a rural hospital or, you know, doesn't have nephrology and they want to do it themselves. Is this something like, couldn't you figure it out pretty easily? I mean, could you just put some urine on a slide and put it under a microscope? And is it pretty easy to see?
It is easy. And as I said, I practice in private practice. And when I went private, I went in deep Mississippi. And there was only a small microscope and centrifuge for 2 minutes and just put it on the slide and take a look at it. You don't need any special stains or anything, no.
Okay, great. So people can try this. Certainly, you know, ideally learn it from someone who knows, but yes, can give you some good information. You know, I know my father, who trained in, you know, medicine in the 70s, you know, always would bemoan the fact that when he was a trainee, you know, they did all their own. They'd spun their own hematocrit and they looked at all the urine and the blood and everything under the microscope themselves. And there were microscopes right there on every floor. And this is how you did it. And now not only is it hard, you know, their microscopes aren't there, but people don't even know how to do it. So it's good to know this is something maybe people could do.
Yes. And I think there are some, it's in the works in other big companies that are trying to have automatic machine that can spell out, you know, once you put the urine, they'll spit out the results, but that's for the future. Yeah. And it may be available to the surgical patients.
Great. All right. So we have this Lasix challenge as a way to prognosticate. Let's say you have a patient, rising creatinine, oliguric. You decide to do a Lasix challenge. Let's say you look at, you know, you say to your nephrology friend, you know, can you take a look at this urine? And they see a bunch of muddy brown casts. All right, so we feel like this is ATN. You say, all right, let's do a Lasix challenge. You give the Lasix. If they respond, as we said, that's good in two ways. One, you can get some volume off. Two, it's a good prognosis for recovery. Let's say they don't respond. So you give them the Lasix, big slug. Let's say you give 200 of Lasix and 10 of metolazone or 500 of Diaryl, and they do not make any urine. All right, now, in my mind, I'm thinking we better put in a Shiley and talk to our nephrologist, right? Is that right? I mean, if they fail that Lasix challenge, is it time to think about dialysis?
I would not yet. And I think there was a good trials for CRT that looked at early versus late. And people who they tried to do the dialysis sooner compared to late ones, the outcomes are similar. And people who they waited, some patients with the natural recovery, you know, they'll pick the creatinine plateau and get better. So wait for the indications. Not wait too long. But if you wait it, there was a Ekiki study that also showed that if you wait it out until they have the traditional indications, then they should do fine. It's just that the new concept is kidney demand versus capacity. You know, what is the demand, electrolyte demand, so solid demand that can kidney handle versus what is demand versus how much kidneys can, what is the demand in the body versus how much kidneys can handle. There's a onco ICU, we go there sometimes, we go often. There's a patient is making 2 liters of urine and the patient is getting 6 liters of fluid every day. That patient, I may dialyze him tonight. Versus there's a patient in medical ICU, surgical ICU, who is making like 600 cc's of urine, creatinine is going up to 4 and 5. He could plateau and come down, so I could wait it out. it's a little bit of, some of them are gray zone indications, but generally we wait for, in the last 20, 30 years, it hasn't changed. We'll just wait for a typical indication for dialysis. But if it is a Friday night, then yeah, sure, we can plan to get a SILE, and so that we don't get into emergency situation. Yeah.
Right. Great. Okay. Yeah, I think that's really important. You know, is we often maybe pull the, or at least we in the ICU, we think, oh, we need to dialyze. And we often hear from you all, well, not yet, right? I mean, the volume status is okay. They're not about to get reintubated. Their potassium is fine. Their, you know, pH is fine. So just because they're not making urine and not responding to diuresis doesn't mean we have to dialyze them right away, right? Some of those people will actually recover. And then, you know, dialysis is no small thing. We're putting a big line in the neck. There's complications possible from that. You know, the dialysis itself, there's a lot of reasons why it's not a no-risk procedure. So if we don't have to do it, then waiting may be a good idea.
That's correct. And I have to point out one more thing is that how much to wait, that's also, that was answered by AKI-2, AKI study, and AKI-2, they compared like wait, but delayed, and then long delay. They compared those two patients also. If you wait too long also, it's not good. So somewhere in the middle, it's just a U-shaped curve, yeah.
Right, great, okay. Now, let me ask you about a different patient. Let's say you have a patient who, you know, let's say they had a big surgery, they got a lot of volume, maybe they had a little bit of post-op complications, and so they got some more volume. Now they're, you know, 15, 20 liters up, but they're okay. You know, they're making good urine. But not a lot of urine. They're not, you know, their potassium's fine. Their acidosis is resolved. Their kidneys are working. And let's even say their creatinine is normal, okay? But they're just not, like every day they're still accumulating a little more fluid. And you give them some Lasix and they pee like crazy, right? And it works perfectly. So my question, I've always wondered, why? Why does that patient with normal kidneys and not AKI, why do they need that Lasix to help them in that scenario?
I think them, even though the creatinine may have been fine on the patients, that was subsets of patients in the FACT trial. I'm quoting FACTT FACT trial. That's what they compared, a liberal versus conservative fluid. Your creatinine, although this patient doesn't have clinical AKI, but your creatinine is diluted. Even if the patient, two patients who is euvolemic versus the patient who you're talking about has 15 liters of fluid, even that patient's creatinine 1 may have been really 1.5 or 2. So he is the type of patient who may have an AKI that's not manifested because of fluid overload. And that's one of the patients that get missed. And they have looked at subset of these kind of patients and follow-up on this patient, they have poor outcomes on this patient, increased morbidity, increased hospitalization, and increased mortality, yeah.
Okay, so that patient probably does have an AKI, we just can't see it. And if we were, maybe if we were checking a different biomarker, we would see it.
Yeah, or you can, if you just adjust the fluid that he got, you can still get to the, you can correct the creatinine, you can diagnose without a biomarker also.
Okay, interesting. All right, so let's talk about, do we have a treatment for AKI, or is it just a waiting game? We just have to wait and see if it gets better.
If it is ATN, it's just a waiting and supportive game. And KDIGO, that's one of the classification system we use that came out in 2012. I was talking about, they have a bundle called KDIGO bundle, and they looked at the subset. They followed those patients in the cardiothoracic ICU. Some patients, they used KDIGO bundle, and remaining patients, they used standard treatment. They have shown that improved outcomes. Not by a whole lot, because standard group also may have followed a little bit of KDIGO education, like good sugar control, hemodynamic support. Those are the only things we can do. And medication dosing, that's something I like personally, is dosing medications, and so that the same vancomycin doesn't get overdosed because of kidney excretion. It may not be vancomycin overdosed, but it's just that vancomycin didn't clear because the patient has had an AKI. And we all know that if you have an insult on the kidney today, and the rise in creatinine takes 48 to 72 hours to get manifested. And the creatinine, you know, during that time, if the drug doesn't clear. So supportive treatment and diuresis volume management, or diuresis, no diuresis, if the patient is fluid down, give them fluid. I think that's the only thing we can do at this moment if they have ATN.
Okay. And obviously, if it's AIN, you know, you figure out the offending drug, stop it. If it's, you know, what about steroids? Do you do steroids for AIN?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's treatment there. If it's prerenal, obviously, then the answer is make them not prerenal anymore.
I think we now internal medicine are catching up to surgeons. Here, I'll give you credit, is like type of fluid that you want to give. I think we are more heading towards more balanced solutions compared to normal saline. There are like four trials that came out recently with fluid to give. The first one is SMART, are the ones who showed improved outcomes, improved kidney recovery rates on these patients. And the last one that came out basically did not show much difference, but there is still some signal that balanced fluid is helpful to us, low chloride, that causes less autonomic changes in hemodynamic changes in the renal vasculature. So plasma light or Ringer's lactate. Ringer's lactate is no different than plasma light. So yeah.
Yeah, great. Yeah, and you know, I agree. I think with the exception maybe of people with traumatic brain injury, where there seemed to be a trend toward worse outcomes with the balanced salt solutions, I think, you know, for the most part, we still use LR or plasma light over normal saline for those reasons you said. If it's post-obstructive, you know, again, when we see post-obstructive, it's usually a kinked Foley or a clotted off Foley. You know, obviously there are other possibilities, but that there's obviously treatment for that or fixing that. But really for the majority of this, which as you said, is going to be ATN, it's supportive care, making sure to avoid nephrotoxic medications, making sure to avoid hypovolemia and, you know, and hoping to avoid dialysis. And then of course, if it gets bad enough, as you said, then the treatment is dialysis. When a patient needs to go on CRRT, continuous dialysis in the ICU, do you have any idea what percentage of people will get kidney function back versus what percent will never get it back?
That's one of the focus of my research when I was a fellow. And close to 60% of patients who had AKI recovered. On dialysis, they recovered. But there's some, it's type of patients who, what they had at the baseline. People who had good baseline creatinine, did not have proteinuria, and did not have heart failure, the likelihood of improvement coming off the dialysis is very high. Compared to patients who had baseline creatinine of GFR of less than 45, or they had like 2 grams of proteinuria and some heart failure, those are patients who may not recover. So when you are talking to the patients, I think who is the patient, what is his baseline characteristic, it helps us to stratify which kind of patients is going to recover or which kind of patient is not going to recover.
Great. Is it true that the single biggest risk factor for post-op AKI is pre-op chronic renal insufficiency?
Yes. And there is there are some scoring system that are available. It's mostly for cardiothoracic surgeries. There is like the Mehta score or Thacker scores that are available that can risk prediction models that you can use it and discuss with the patients. And when I was a fellow, we used to see them preoperatively also, and then optimize their medications, stopping the metformin, optimizing the statins or beta blockers. You can optimize them preoperatively also, even if they have baseline, and then risk stratify and take care of them accordingly. Yeah.
Okay, great. Let me ask you, this came up a little bit before, but you know, we often, one cause or purported cause of AKI that we haven't talked about is contrast. And so we hear this all the time. You know, we will say, oh, we can't do, you know, we need to know if this patient has a PE, but we can't do the CT because they have an AKI and we don't want to box their kidneys, right? We hear this all the time. Tell me about that, because, you know, we're starting to hear from both the radiologists and some nephrologists that maybe that's in no longer the case.
That's correct. And that concept is used to be called renalism, and R-E-N-A-L-I-S, and renalism. And because of that, I think a lot of our patients, they may not have gotten enough imaging studies that would have helped them to treat them. So there are subsets of patients who we want to avoid the contrast, like we have very advanced chronic kidney disease, proteinuria, bad diabetes, heart failure, if at all possible. Otherwise, remaining patients, we can help them preoperatively or pre-contrast, and then they should get contrast. And some of the studies that has been done recently, they looked at all the structural changes, biomarkers, when they get a contrast. There is no signal on that. It was just a hemodynamic changes because of the contrast. That's number one. Number two is, last 20 years, we have gotten better at our imaging studies also. Even with small contrast volume, we get excellent images. So that's other way to reduce the contrast loading to the patient. So, yeah.
Yeah, great. So I think this is really important that the concept of contrast-induced kidney injury is, you know, not what we think. It's really low likelihood unless, as you said, someone's got severe chronic kidney injury, heart failure, proteinuria, you know, they're really not doing well, then maybe not a great idea. But certain, and even then, there are newer agents, right? Newer contrast agents that even for those patients you can give, right?
Yeah. And then better machines, better CT scan devices, we can do better imaging. And then at this point, I would like to make a distinction between contrast-induced AKI and contrast-associated AKI. Some patients may have, like, who's a septic, a MICU patient or a surgical ICU with bad pancreatitis or pancreatic infection, had on vancomycin aminoglycoside, that, by the way, got a contrast. You will have AKI, but it may not be contrast-induced AKI. It just may be contrast-associated AKI. So some distinctions to be made, yeah.
Right. That's key, right? It's you can easily get an AKI around the time of getting contrast, but it may not be from the contrast, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, okay, I think that's really important. All right, Samir, this has been great. We've covered a lot of really great ground. Anything we didn't get to that you think is important you want to say before we move on?
I think the other thing is the concept of AKI, it's, I think I'm glad we're talking about that. It's high time that everyone gets educated, especially the residents, and drug dosing. And it has got a traction in the national conferences, ASN and ISN. They have a AKI awareness year. That was last year, so that, you know, we can, all of us can go and try to prevent the AKI or severity of the AKI. Each step of severity increases the morbidity and mortality to these patients. And there have been some initiatives that they have, different institutions has used. One of them I would like to point out in particular is NINJA initiative, that most of pediatric population, where the pharmacist was alerted when the patient was getting three different nephrotoxic agent or 3 days of aminoglycoside, that reduced the rate of AKI by 60%. So based on this, there are different electronic alerts that has been studied and are also in process of being studied. One thing is there, it's great. We'll have an extra alert for AKI, but there will be alert fatigue also. So, you know, we have to balance it out, how much alert, because there's already sepsis alert, heart attack, brain alert. So based on that, I think at least we have to be mindful, and I think it has to be inserted to our clinical practice and how we can do that. Yeah,
that's a great point. And, you know, maybe we should just mention some of the worst offenders of medications that cause kidney injury. So aminoglycosides for sure, right? Amphotericin is a big one, right?
Yes.
Vancomycin can do it.
Vancomycin and non-steroidals, NSAIDs, yeah.
Yep, NSAIDs, okay, great. Other big ones, big offenders that come to mind, or are those the main ones?
Those are the main ones, yeah.
Okay, good. So that's really important to keep in mind.
No,
go ahead, Samir, please.
And I just want to point out, some of the rise in creatinine may not be bad rise. And there is an increasing concept about saying permissive hypercreatinemia. And these are the ones, type of patients who have heart failure and are fluid overloaded, you diurese them, and the creatinine bumps up by a certain amount. And these are the patients who have done well. And there's some paradox there. So,
yeah, that's really important, I think, to point out, because, you know, for whatever reason, maybe it's because you're no longer diluting it, but the fact that the creatinine goes up may not be bad. And it certainly isn't because your diuresis is to blame, right? I mean, I always tell the residents, you know, cardiac surgery, almost every patient's creatinine goes down when they first come out of cardiac surgery because of the bypass circuit and the dilution from the fluid. And then not everyone, but a lot of patients will have an AKI after cardiac surgery. So their creatinine will go up in the day or two after. We also are diuresing them during that time because we diurese very quickly in post-cardiac surgery. And it happens a lot that somebody will say, you know, we better stop diuresing because the creatinine's going up. And the fact of the matter is the creatinine is going up because they've got an AKI, not because we're diuresing them, right? And so we want to be very careful about blaming the diuresis for the creatinine rise.
It's just decongestion, yeah.
Right, great. All right, Samir, let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Is there anything, a TV show, a podcast, a movie, a book, anything you would recommend that people check out for fun?
For fun, I'm from Nepal, and I'm inspired by my uncle, and he was a global citizen. There's a book called Global Citizen from Gulmi, GLMI, and where there was no education system. He went to a remote village, even to get a passport, he had to get a permission from a big minister in the country, and he landed up a job in UNICEF. And there's life history, how he had to go to hurdles and what kind of things around the world he did. I think that's inspiring to me. The one funny is a documentary, one of the Nepalese guy, he went to 14 peaks in the world, more than 8,000 feet peaks in the world, and he recorded all these videos that he had, adventurous scenarios, and it's pretty funny. It's in Netflix too. And the other book I like is God of Small Things. It's by Arundhati Roy. She's from India. And she goes through the childhood memories of two children who are underprivileged and a lower caste, and they got happiness on the smaller things. And I think it's pretty, people who are privileged, they don't realize you can be happy even without the money, and in the lower, smaller toys, how they can become happy, how they can get loves. And but at the same time, what are the social discrimination factors? I think this is also inspiring, God of Small Things.
Nice. That's great. Thanks for those recommendations. I also have, I've seen 14 Peaks. It's a really great documentary. Yeah, really fascinating. I'm going to recommend a TV show. I can't remember if I've ever recommended this before, but it is called Never Have I Ever. It's a, I think it's Netflix. It's a...
I watched it. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you? It's funny, right?
It's funny. It's,
and the, it's half hour show, so it's not an hour long commitment. It's funny. It's well done. So if you're looking for something light and fun, check out Never Have I Ever. And then we have an audience random recommendation. This is from Nico Low. And Nico, I apologize if I'm pronouncing your last name incorrectly. It's L-O-U-W, from South Africa, who wrote in to say that he was inspired by the episodes that we've done with authors who've written novels. And so he decided to write a short story of his own that's now available on Amazon at the moment for free. It's got a medical theme, a short story with a medical theme that he wrote. And we will post a link to his short story in the show notes if you want to check it out. Thanks, Nico, for sending that in. All right, Samir, thank you so much. This has been great. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having you, and have a good day.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Sonia Amanat and Chris Reese are our social media managers. Dr. April Liu and Edison Jang are our production assistants. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.